Good morning, everyone. This is indeed a special day in the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit. You certainly know my colleague that sits to my left, Judge Diana Sykes. But we're honored, so honored this morning to have with us our guest, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. And so I know this experience will be something for you, I hope, a memory of a lifetime. I didn't have an opportunity to check every counsel's background to determine if you'd appeared before the Supreme Court. But what an honor it is for you to be here with us this morning. And with that, we'll begin with our first case, Lumberman's.
If I may, I'm honored to be here. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Justice O'Connor. In our first case of the day, Lumberman's Mutual versus Broadspire, Mr. Dasso.
May it please the court. It's also an honor for me to be here anytime in front of the Seventh Circuit, but particularly today, so we appreciate that opportunity. My name is Jim Dasso, and together with my colleague Lauren Lowe, we represent the defendants below and the appellants on this appeal, Broadspire Management Services, Inc., and Platinum Equity. In our view, the primary issue the court needs to decide today or over the next several weeks is whether or not the issue of whether there was a proper and timely disagreement notice was an issue that belonged to the arbitrator, or as we believe, an issue of arbitrability that the court should have decided before he referred the case to arbitration. In our view, the court should have made that fundamental determination about whether or not there was an arbitrable issue here, whether or not the prerequisites to that had been complied with, whether or not the arbitrator had jurisdiction before he referred the matter to the arbitrator. Now, the standard, I think, for deciding this issue was set forth in the case in Housum. And the case in Housum, Supreme Court case in Housum, said not every gateway issue is necessarily an issue that the court needs to decide rather than an arbitrator. But what you should have the court to decide are those issues that it's clear that the parties expected the court to decide. And in our view, the way to decide whether the parties expected the court to decide the issue or the arbitrator to decide the issue depends primarily on the language of the agreements. And we believe that that's where Judge Leinenweber erred in the trial court by not focusing on the language of the agreements, which is very narrow, and instead just sending this off to arbitration without that detailed inspection.
Well, isn't this, when you get to the bottom line of this case, isn't this really a fight over the disagreement notices? And doesn't that include the ultimate purchase price and what it should be? So won't the arbitrator, in other words, be reviewing them anyway to resolve the purchase price dispute?
No, Your Honor. In fact, that's one of my points. One of my points here is that deciding the issues of whether or not there was a timely and valid disagreement notice does not in any way require the district court to delve into the merits of the controversy. Both the Supreme Court in the Housum case and in the Wiley case, as well as this court in Corman, indicated that that was one of the primary concerns about having the judge decide too much at the beginning. The court did not want the district courts delving into the merits of the case. But here you won't have to do that at all. You just have to decide two things. Number one, was there something that was called a disagreement notice sent within the time period, in other words, within the 90 days. If not, under the agreement, it automatically becomes final and binding. And so that's a simple thing that does not require any investigation into the merits at all. And then second thing you have to decide is does it meet the prerequisites laid out in Section 3.3G of the purchase agreement? 3.3G of the purchase agreement says a disagreement notice has to do two things. Number one, it has to lay out in detail what their view is of the problems with the earnout reports. Secondly, it has to give their view of what the correct number is. And my point in this argument is the whole structure of this arbitration provision is that is something that was very important and very substantive.
Well, looking at that Housum case, don't you think that an accounting and appraisal firm is better equipped than the court to determine what constitutes reasonable detail in such notice, particularly when it's precisely those details that the arbitrator will be evaluating for the purpose of resolving the underlying disputes?
No, I don't, Your Honor. A couple points. In Howsam, as the court knows, that involved an NASD forum-specific issue. And in that forum-specific thing, the Supreme Court decided that the parties would expect someone, such as an arbitrator who knew about the NASD, to decide those issues. That arbitrator was familiar with whether or not how to apply those rules and how they've been applied in the past. Here, I don't think that the issues that needed to be decided are more better decided by an accountant by the district court. Here, you really have issues that the court is dealing with all the time, district court. You're deciding, number one, issues of contract interpretation, looking at the contractual language. What did the parties really mean by this contractual language, and how should it be interpreted? And second, applying that to the issues, applying that to the disagreement notice, whether or not this met the intention of the parties. Now, to address the specific point that you asked, Judge Williams, whether or not the arbitrator was better to decide that issue of whether or not there was reasonable detail or the court, if you look at the contract, there's actually a schedule, I think it's 3.3A, but I can find it and tell you during rebuttal the exact thing. But it lays out and it shows what reasonable detail is. It has a kind of an example of what you expect in terms of reasonable detail, both for the earnout reports themselves, and then conversely, that would also kind of show what you would have for reasonable detail for the disagreement notice. So I don't think you need to be an accountant, or being an accountant does in any way help you decide whether or not a particular letter or document qualifies and meets those standards. What you really have here is an issue of a contract is laid out, it establishes certain standards, and it makes clear that the district court then looks at those standards and applies them to the particular case before them, and that's what district courts do all the time. So I think a district court has comparative expertise in that area. On the other hand, an accountant has comparative expertise in deciding the issues, the underlying accounting issues, and we believe once those are before the accountant, absolutely those need to be decided by the accountant.
The problem with your argument, counsel, is that the contract argument that you're making doesn't go to the validity of the agreement to arbitrate. It only goes to the question of whether a condition precedent was satisfied, and that's typically a question for the arbitrator. That's the distinction in the case, that the case is raw. You know, you're not trying to undermine with your contract argument the agreement to arbitrate. You're just saying that this particular condition precedent wasn't validly complied with, and that's quintessentially a question for an arbitrator.
I disagree, Your Honor, and here's why. I do understand that in making certain decisions that the courts say, for example, if you claim fraud, you have to claim fraud with respect to the particular agreement to arbitrate rather than fraud with respect to the entire contract in order to get out of the arbitration. Understand that. But we're in a different arena now, and the arena here is controlled by Howsam, Greentree, and First Options. And in that arena, what you need to do is decide whether or not kind of gateway issues are something that go to the arbitrator or go to the court. And the issue that needs to be decided is whether or not the parties intended the court or the arbitrator to decide that issue. And for me, the important thing here that needs to be focused on is the language of the agreement. What you have in all of those cases that talk about arbitration and having to void the particular arbitration agreement all have very broad arbitration clauses in them. They all say things like any controversy arising under this particular agreement or any issue arising under this agreement needs to go to the arbitrator. And the courts legitimately say when you have language like that, then you assume that any issues go there to the arbitrator unless there's a good reason not to. In this particular case, we have something completely different. We have language here which says an arbitrator only has the ability to go forward and even be hired if there has been a valid disagreement notice. So you have to go back and start with the language of the agreement because arbitration is a matter of contract.
Well, how do you distinguish between the Fifth Circuit and Sixth Circuit cases that talk about procedural conditions precedent to arbitrability, whether something should be arbitrated, because we've got the the Fifth Circuit case, the dealer case. Payment of fees was a procedural condition precedent that the court shouldn't have to review. The Sixth Circuit case, JPD, question of whether the party had failed to satisfy the condition precedent to arbitration when it failed to document certain calculations. Aren't those really analogous to our situation?
Your Honor, I would make 2 points. Number one is I haven't read those cases. They weren't cited in the thing. But my guess is, having read a lot of cases in this area, that those cases, in fact, dealt with very broad arbitration clauses. In other words, that those cases dealt with arbitration clauses that said any case or controversy under this contract needs to go. And when you have a clause like that, if you have any issues then arising with it, by definition, they go to the arbitrator. Here we have something different. We have different contractual language. So you need to start with the contractual language rather than starting with legal principles, because ultimately arbitration is a matter of contract. What did the parties contract for? What did they agree upon? And what was their intention?
Well, yes, but Howsam stands for the proposition that arbitrability is going to be presumably decided by the arbitrators initially. I mean, you have to start there and convince us that, no, it has to be decided by the court. And that isn't how the cases have been proceeding.
Yeah, I think
in federal courts.
Sorry, Your Honor. I think that Howsam says that the issue of arbitrability is presumably for the judge. Unless there's clear and unequivocal evidence to the contrary, the judge should decide the issue of arbitrability. Then the question is whether or not this is an issue over the scope of the arbitration provision, in which case it should go to the arbitrator, or is this an issue of arbitrability, which we view it as, which it should then be decided by the court as a threshold issue. And Howsam says, how do you decide that? And it says you decide that by looking at the intent of the parties. What would the parties have intended? It says where the parties would likely have expected a court to decide the gateway matter. And my point here today, my ultimate point is that in deciding what would the parties have ultimately expected, you need to look at the contract language.
Well, in that contract language, you've got, in addition to Article 3, where most of fight is in this case, there's a broad arbitration clause in Article 14 of the contract that is comprehensive and refers to the arbitrability of all disputes under the agreement. So even accepting your interpretation of Article 3, that it applies in a very specific way to earn-out payouts, doesn't that just dump this case back into the general arbitration clause? And so it's really not a case that belongs in court?
Yeah, and we actually did argue Section 1411 applied. If you look in the district court, one of the things the district
court... You're not arguing that here. Is that waived, that issue, here? You didn't
no,
raise
Your Honor,
it.
We haven't specifically raised the issue because
no,
we
didn't.
Believe the right decision is that this belongs, before you get to any arbitration provision, this belongs to the court. And, in fact, if you look at 1411, which is the section you're referring to, there's actually a carve-out provision that talks about specific performance, and it leaves certain things to the court, even despite the broad language of 1411. But your point more fundamentally is, well, you have broad language in 1411. Well, we're not in 1411. We argued we should be there because the arbitration forum in 1411 is a different forum. It's a forum that would be made up of lawyers, presumably, not accountants. And we believe lawyers should be deciding these issues, not accountants. And in fact, one of the things we argued in the district court was exactly that, that 1411 should apply.
But you did not raise that argument here.
Did not, Your Honor.
So it's waived. We don't have to reach that.
I am not arguing that 1411 is applied here. Correct.
So the answer is yes.
Well, I'm not sure what you mean waived. I mean, our argument is that's not our position on appeal. I mean, it was our position in the trial court. If logically you say, well, if it falls out of this one, it goes to the next one, I mean, presumably that would be something that would come up in the court's decision.
All right. You're into your rebuttal time. You want to save the rest of your time. Thank you, Mr. Dasso. Mr. Fox.
Good morning, and I'll just echo Mr. Dasso's comments. What a pleasure it is to appear before this panel. Let me start by commenting on an issue that was raised with Mr. Dasso during his presentation, which is the narrow versus the broad scope of the arbitration clauses in 3.4 and in 14.11. It's true that the arbitration clause in 3.4 is narrow in the sense that it is intended to apply only to purchase price disputes, not to any other kind of dispute that might arise under the contract. But once you are in 3.4, once you have a purchase price dispute, and it is absolutely undisputed that that is what we are dealing with here, then there is very broad language about giving the arbitrator the power to conduct any proceedings or do any take any steps or actions that the arbitrator needs to take to resolve those disputes. The structure of this process is interesting because what is contemplated here is that the burden is on the buyer, Broadspire, the appellant here, to calculate in the first instance these earn-out and buyout calculations and to send a report within a certain period of time to Lumbermans with their calculation. There's no dispute that happened here. What was then supposed to happen was that the buyer was supposed to, and I'm quoting here, make available to seller all books and records of the company and the subsidiaries in buyer's possession or control that are relevant to such review. Now, it's been demonstrated, and the record shows, that that obligation was repeatedly shirked. Okay, we had to go back to court not once but twice to force them to provide documents. PricewaterhouseCoopers, which heard the original post-closing adjustment arbitration, and began to hear the 04 earnout dispute repeatedly, and at least two times that are documented in the record, ruled in writing that Broadspire had not done what it was supposed to do, had not provided relevant books and records. In fact, the first time through, they wouldn't even let us take away copies of the documents. They said, well, you can come down to Plantation, Florida, and sit in a room with boxes and boxes of documents and look at them. No electronic records, no paper records. So one of the big disputes in this case has always been, has Broadspire complied with its obligation, which is really the preceding obligation, to make the information available? The language of 3.3G, which is the language dealing with disagreement notices, says, if as a result of such review, that is the seller's review of the materials made available by the buyer, if as a result of such review, seller disagrees with buyer's report, seller shall deliver to buyer a disagreement notice, and then it goes on to describe the disagreement notice. But the stepping off point for our provision of that kind of disagreement notice was the buyer's compliance with their obligation to make books and records available, something that they repeatedly refused to do, something we had two different federal judges decide they hadn't done, something that PricewaterhouseCoopers twice decided they hadn't done, and something that Deloitte, which is the arbitrator now, has repeatedly decided they haven't
done. And as I understand your argument, you're saying that the reason your disagreement notices fell short was because this information was not adequately provided.
Well, without embracing the idea that they fell short, yes, I think you're exactly right, Judge. I think that Judge Sykes is exactly right that we don't have a situation where we had some obligation in a vacuum. This was a condition, arguably a condition precedent to the arbitration, so too was their obligation to make books and records available, which would enable us to do that calculation. So we really were in a situation where we had 90 days to provide a disagreement notice. Broadspire was refusing to give us documents and records we had requested. As the clock ticked, rather than simply let the 90 days pass by, we sent a disagreement notice which said, you haven't provided us with what you're supposed to provide us. We disagree with what your calculation. We believe it's erroneous in a number of respects. Here are some of the issues we have with it, but we are unable to provide a competing calculation because you haven't given us the materials from which we could do that. So that was really the core issue before the district court. And I think it's interesting. On April 15th, 2008, there's really two orders that are before this court. The first was the April 15th, 2008, memorandum opinion and order of the district court, in which the district court found that timely buyout and earnout reports had been sent, timely disagreement notices had been sent in response. There were disputes over the adequacy of both. In other words, was the buyout and earnout report sufficient? Had the documents and records been provided? Were the disagreement notices compliant? Those were all issues that the parties were quarreling about. But the district court, and by the way, you know, we talked about, is it really an issue for, is it better for a lawyer to decide or a court to decide or an accounting arbitrator to decide? These were all issues which were tied into very complex and detailed business records, financial records, of an insurance company, which, it took me a long time to figure out what some of these concepts and documents meant. I can only imagine, Judge Leinenweber, with his busy calendar, having to sit down and sort through, bankers' boxes of complex financial records to determine whether what Broadspire had provided to us was sufficient and compliant and adequate under the purchase agreement. It would have been an impossible task for him. And so he decided correctly that whether the disagreement notices were adequate, and there was no dispute they were timely, he said, quote, is certainly within the purview of the arbitrator and not the court, particularly where, as here, the professed basis for failing to supply detail was based on the claimed lack of relevant information supplied. Whether Lumbermans adequately disputed the buyer's report or whether it had sufficient information to do so is peculiarly within the competence of an independent accounting or appraisal firm of national reputation, that's the language of the contract, rather than within the competence of a federal court. And I think he was spot on correct when he found that.
And Howsam and the cases that we discussed with Mr. Dasso, do you have a different view of those cases and what they stand for?
Well, I do, Your Honor. And I think, Howsam actually, I think, supports our position. Howsam was the broker dispute. And what Howsam, the issue in Howsam, let me just find my notes on that if you give me a moment. The issue in Howsam was whether the court or the arbitrator should decide whether an NASD time limit to file a grievance about a trade should be invoked to bar the arbitration. And the court held, not in Mr. Dasso's favor, it held it was a question for the arbitrator. And it cited approvingly from the Revised Uniform Arbitration Act of 2000, quote, arbitrator shall decide whether a condition, and this is Judge Sykes's point, arbitrator shall decide whether a condition precedent to arbitrability has been fulfilled. Plain language in the Howsam case. I'm not really sure I understand why Mr. Dasso thinks that case helps him. Of course, the original leading case in this area is the Wiley case, the Supreme Court's case from 45 years ago. And basically, the issue there was whether a successor in interest was bound to a collective bargaining agreement that the acquired company had agreed to. But the secondary issue in the case was whether or not the grievance was time-barred, basically, that had been filed too late. And the court said that's not the court's issue. That is the arbitrator's issue. And unless the relief sought, and this is the court's language, is, quote, so plainly unreasonable that the subject matter of the dispute must be – the subject matter of the dispute must be regarded as non-arbitrable. There's one – the court after – the district court, after it ruled on April 15th, then sent us back to try and negotiate an engagement letter with Deloitte after it ruled Deloitte should hear the dispute. And we spent months trying to come to terms. Deloitte had its own agenda in terms of what it wanted in the engagement letter. Each of the parties were trying to, I think, if I can characterize it, Broadspire was trying to inject language which would have limited the role of the arbitrator. And we had a hearing on October 31st, and I think it's very telling. I'd like to just read you an exchange between myself, the court, and Mr. Dasso on what the arbitrator should decide, because I think it is really very much in conflict with the position they are taking here today. So this is an October 31, 2008 hearing in open court. So my statement to the court, so Broadspire is basically saying, even if we did not give you the information you needed, if you didn't give us a disagreement notice with an alternative calculation, that's the end of the story and nothing else can happen. Deloitte can't consider the merits. That's essentially the position they are taking here today. The court, it was my view that the arbitrator should take a look at this and determine whether or not there was compliance, the arbitrator. And that's up to the arbitrator, not up to me to say what is adequate compliance. And then Mr. Dasso responded, that's almost exactly word for word what we say. We say the arbitrator will determine compliance, and if the arbitrator determines compliance, we will move forward, end quote. Now, I really am at a loss to understand how Mr. Dasso can make the arguments he's making here today when he made that statement in open court to the district court. And it really was part of the basis for the district court's December 11 ruling, which basically sent all of these issues to the arbitrator. Am I running short on time?
No, you're fine.
Okay, good. So I think if you go through the cases, the Wiley case, the Zurich American case, and I think of particular interest here is the Kuna Mutual Insurance case cited in both parties' briefs. The argument there was that the grievance notice did not provide sufficient detail. It was supposed to articulate the specific provision in the collective bargaining agreement that the grievance supposedly arose under. It involved an outsourcing of employees, and it didn't identify that provision, and it didn't articulate outsourcing as a disputed issue. And the company took the very position that Broad Spire takes here, that the arbitrator did not have jurisdiction to hear that issue, that the content of the grievance was insufficient, and that that was a matter of arbitrability. And this court said, no, that is not a, quote, true question of arbitrability, and said Kuna, quote, dresses up its arguments about the scope of the arbitrator's authority in arbitrability clothing. True arbitrability, and this again is the court, true arbitrability clauses tend to use language that excludes specific subject matters from arbitration, not disputes arising within those topics. And this goes exactly back to the difference between 1411, which expressly does not apply to purchase price disputes, but applies to everything else, and 3.4, which applies only to purchase price disputes. And it makes perfect sense. Why? Because 3.4 is supposed to be considered by a national accounting firm that is going to be able to make some sense out of these very complex records. And if it's a more pedestrian kind of a dispute, a more typical contract dispute, yes, that's something a regular arbitrator can hear and consider. So the scope of 3.4 is narrow, but the breadth of the arbitrator's authority, once you have a purchase price dispute, that narrow category of disputes, is quite broad, quite broad. Unless the panel has any questions.
No questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fox. And how much time does he have? 2 minutes. Mr. Dassel.
May it please the court. I just wanted to make a couple points. Number one, I don't think I answered Judge Williams' questions about the other cases. I didn't get to my second point. And that is, my view is that the Corman case, which we've cited from this court, if nothing else, stands for the proposition that you can't just neatly divide things into timeliness and other issues. And once you say it's timeliness, then automatically it goes to the arbitrator. You have to look beyond the label and actually look and make a decision about whether or not it meets the criteria or standard for an issue of arbitrability set out in Howsam.
Yeah, but in Corman, the parties disputed whether the grievance was timely under the terms of an expired collective bargaining agreement.
I understand, Your Honor. The point, though, was timeliness in that case was the issue in before the court in Corman. And the court said, well, timeliness in this instance goes to the court.
But here there's no question as to whether there's a fundamental agreement between the parties to arbitrate price disputes.
But I think there is an agreement about whether or not that agreement expired. Because you look at the structure of the contract says you get 90 days, and if you don't do something within 90 days, it expires. It's over, everything's final and done, you're finished. And I think actually this is closer to Corman in the sense that it does deal with an agreement to arbitrate that expires, that by its own terms expires after 90 days. And again, we haven't talked about the Brookfield case, but I think the Brookfield case is directly on point.
Well, in Corman, the entire agreement expired. This agreement is still in effect.
Correct.
It's hardly appropriate to characterize it as an expired agreement and therefore on all fours with Corman.
I didn't say it was on all fours with Corman.
Well, even analogous under the circumstances.
What I said, Your Honor, was what Corman says, if nothing else, is you can't just give it something a label and says timeliness is something that goes to the arbitrator every time and all issues go to the judge. For example, my point in the end is we need to look at the contract language. And I'm continuing my answer if the court will hear it. My time is up.
Yes, it is.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Thank
you can finish your sentence if you had one thought.
No.
But all right.
I made
okay.
My
all
thank
right.
You very much for
all
this
right.
Time.
Thank you, Mr. Dassel. Thank you, Mr. Fox. We will take the case under advisement. Thank you for